This is Orson Welles, speaking from London.
To keep you in suspense.
I had a be everyday grind.
Night transmissions. Gary Clinton here with show 44 of Night Transmissions. This first show tonight is a new one for Night Transmissions, and it's called Crime Classic. In the golden age of radio, there were a number of true crime shows. This is one of the best. I'm not going to spend a whole lot of time introducing it because the show does a pretty good job of introducing itself. The only kind of strange thing I've run into so far is that most references I have been able to find give the dates for this show as being in 1953 and 1954. However, the MP3 tag in this particular show gives the air date as December the 3rd of 1952. Well, that's pretty close to 1953. And I do have some reason to believe that this is the very first show ever run. But, of course, you have probably figured it out. I really don't know.
Good evening. This is Crime Classics. I am Thomas Harlan. Listen. The man in nondescript uniform dropping stones into that well is a mercenary soldier, more recently a deserter. He's testing the depth of the well, the only way he knows, since a length of rope is not immediately available, and more complicated machines are as yet undiscovered. This is the year 1778, and the deserter is named James Buchanan. Next to him is his friend, another deserter whose name is William Brooks. These men are in the employ of Mrs. Bathsheba Spooner of Brookfield, Massachusetts, whose well it is. Mrs. Spooner will pay these men immediately they deposit the body of her murdered husband, right down there. And tonight, my report to you on the crime of Bathsheba Spooner, the first woman to be tried for murder in the United States. Crime Classics, a new series of true crime stories taken from the records and newspapers of every land, from every time. Your host each week, Mr. Thomas Highland, connoisseur of crime, student of violence, and teller of murders. Now, once again, Thomas Highland. The place is Brookfield, Massachusetts, the year 1778. Scene? The home of Joshua and Bathsheba Spooner. A large and respectable dwelling, two stories in height, situated on the north side of the road from Brookfield to Worcester. In the front of it and nearly opposite on the south side of the road are stately elms and a well. And in the living room, there's this.
What manner of woman are you, Bathsheba? There's no content in you and no happiness.
And what happiness have you given me? A life that dies quickly. Cooking and sewing. And from you, drunken sleep.
And you've not answered me. You would like to see me dead, would you not?
Listen to me, Joshua. When you returned this morning from Worcester, my heart sank in me. I'd hoped you wouldn't come back.
That I would have an accident. That in some way I would be killed.
Yes.
That you would be free then.
Yes.
To walk the town. Newly widowed with a wandering eye.
Yes.
And you listen true. I am your husband, and I'm your lover, and that's the way things are.
Old man! Old man! Ezra? Ezra?
I've been waiting. Bathsheba.
Wait.
No more waiting, Bathsheba. The time I was away from you, with your husband in Worcester. The thinking about you.
And there'll be more waiting. Until it's done. Until you kill him.
I tried, but I could not.
He asked me a question, my husband did. What manner of woman are you, he asked. Now I wonder. What manner of woman am I to love such as you, a youth? A boy who pretends to manhood. You, without the courage to...
The poison you gave me. There was no opportunity, Bathsheba.
And a boy who lies. Opportunity. When it becomes nighttime, my husband becomes a drunkard. You know that. To empty the poison in the cup when you were with him, a simple thing like that, you couldn't do.
I swear it to you, Bathsheba. He'll die.
When? Go to him now. To the tavern where he is. Empty the poison.
I threw the poison away.
With no courage.
Bathsheba.
Speak my name and bedevil yourself with it.
Just kiss me, Bathsheba.
No kisses. No secret whisperings. None of that. No more. Until my husband is dead. Laugh then, you'll see I mean it.
There's a wench, Bathsheba, at the other end of town. And she watches me when I walk by.
Then go to her.
All right.
Wait. Don't leave me.
You almost let me go.
Boy. Boy. You...
Bathsheba.
Kill him. Kill my husband.
Later.
And that was Bathsheba Spooner. You've come to know her pretty well. You've seen her hating. You've seen her loving. There's more you should know. She was the sixth child of an illustrious man, General Ruggles. The general was a man of great wealth and lived in a style of unusual luxury for that day. He kept 30 horses and had a park of 20 acres for deer and a pack of hounds for the amusement of numerous visitors. He was a man intensely loyal to the British crown and never hid his loyalties. And so, at the outbreak of the Revolutionary War, he was forced to give up his estate and to leave the country. His married life was also pretty bad, and he and his wife did not set a good example to his children in their conjugal relations. Bathsheba sprang from that kind of a household. Her loyalist background in time of war, and the very fact of the name she had, Bathsheba, were sufficient cause for the town in which she lived to view her with alarm. But keep this in mind. Bathsheba Spooner is going to murder her husband. How? Well, let's see how time and motive and circumstance conspire to get a man violently dead. The man, Joshua Spooner. Let's pick him up and see what he's doing. It's the same evening, and since it's after dark, he's drinking. And in Brookfield, there's only one public house in which to drink, Cooley's Tavern. And that's where he is.
Oh, no, 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 Doctor.
Eh?
And what would you do?
To trap General Burgoyne? Very simple. Hand me your tankard, Dr. King. Now, and here, this spoon, the line of march of Burgoyne.
Uh-huh.
And your tankard and mine, two sections of the troops of General Washington.
Uh-huh.
Now watch.
And that's how we take care of General Burgoyne.
Yeah, yeah. Barkeep, more ale.
Joshua Spooner talks of strategies and drinks his ale. But mark this. Near the bar, another table. Two men. Men in nondescript uniforms. Deserters from the army of General Burgoyne. Their names? James Buchanan and William Brooks. They've made known the fact that they've deserted the enemy, so their drinks are on the house and the appreciative customers. They're having a fine time.
Drink, drink your ale, Will. Make me a toast and I'll drink with you.
And a toast you shall get. Burgoyne is a scurvy...
Louder, Will, louder, else we'll pay for our own ale.
Aye. A toast. Aye, I'll give you a toast to that scurvy, plump, bellied Burgoyne. May he rot in the wilderness.
That is if he don't drown coming across the St. Lawrence.
Gentlemen.
And a merry evening to you.
Joshua Spooner is my name, and it would do me proud if you would permit me...
Ale is what we're drinking, sir.
Hail for the patriarch!
And patriots we are indeed, goodness.
Oh, yes. We joined General Washington, sir, and his colonials. You should know that. And from here, we go to Worcester, where a column of Washington's heart is a... Oh, ale. To you, sir, and thanks to you.
My pleasure.
Willy Bach, your tankard is dry, and so is mine.
If you will permit me, gentlemen, it would be my pleasure. My pleasure indeed.
It would be Mr. Spooner's pleasure indeed to buy the lads more ale, as was the custom. True, it was 1778, but the etiquette was the same. Nothing too good for our boys. And the deserters in Cooley's bar were off to join our boys. As a matter of fact, it was Mr. Spooner's pleasure to direct James Buchanan and William Brooks to Worcester to become soldiers in Washington's army. It just happened that one of the landmarks that Mr. Spooner gave the lads went something like this.
Now, mark you, a pile of elms and a well, and across the road from it, my house. When you pass there, you will be leaving Brookfield, and you will know you're on your way. We'll have another ale before you leave.
You're a gentleman if I ever met one.
Oh, a true one, James, my lad. A real gent.
So they touched tankards, the deserters and Joshua Spooner, and they made tearful farewell. And the deserters left and walked the road toward where the elms were, and a house, and a well. Let's go on ahead of them. Let's get back to the lady. Bathsheba's home. Bathsheba's fixing her hair. And the youth Ezra, he's tying into it night ribbons. A lover's tender gesture. Their talk, however, is shocking.
Perhaps you're right. Perhaps the best way is not to poison him.
I say shoot him.
Perhaps, in such a way as to make it appear as an accident. Will you shoot him, Ezra? Tightly with the ribbon, dear. Ezra?
I have not the courage for it.
But you know of guns and shooting. You were in the army for a year.
I marched. I shot no one. I marched upon an ambush and was wounded. Myself, I never pulled a trigger.
If not you to kill him, Ezra, then someone.
Yes. Turn from your mirror, Bathsheba, and look at me.
Oh, listen. You hear?
Yes. Drunkards.
Someone. Go to the window.
Drunkards. Two of them by the moon. British deserters. I've seen them in town.
Call to them.
Bathsheba.
Call to them.
Hello! You there!
What do you want?
I'll talk to them.
A lady wants to talk to you.
A lady? At a lady's service any time.
Let them in, Ezra.
The Bathsheba Spooner who greeted the deserters must have been quite a sight. Tall, long hair, and blue ribbons. There must have been a fire in the fireplace, and in all probability she was standing in front of it. Her manner was gracious, and she was smiling. Ezra served the liquor. All in all, it was the nicest thing that could possibly have happened to two fellows who had deserted General Burgoyne.
And now, gentlemen, a question.
We bow. Bow, James, my lad. Say on, my lady.
How would you gentlemen like 500 pounds to see you on your long journey?
Merchanut would warm the cockles, wouldn't it, Will?
Twould. Does that answer you, my lady?
And what would you do for it?
There is nothing that Will and I have not done. And for less handsome payment from less handsome women.
Far less.
Kill my husband.
This lad, the one you call Ezra...
Come here, lad. The next skinny ones don't take long for twisting.
Bathsheba!
Not him. Not Ezra.
Not him, James.
Then who?
My husband will return from his drinking. Will you wait for him? Kill him? When he returns, meet him outside at the door and greet him. Will you?
Not only for the money, dear lady, but for the pleasure of your presence to two tired soldiers. Right, Dave?
It's the truth.
You be the master of this house.
Yeah. And you are the tool...
That we be.
This one was a struggler, he will.
Get the woman. And the one she calls Ezra.
Aye.
Mrs. Spooner, come see, it is done.
And a tidy job, if I say so myself, Mrs. Spooner.
And now he's dead.
What will you do with him?
There's a well across the road.
Ah. Give us a hand, James. And you, Ezra.
I'll walk with you.
It's a deep well.
Poor little man.
And that's how Joshua Spooner died. And that's how Bathsheba Spooner killed him. You are listening to Crime Classics and your host, Thomas Highland. And now, once again, Thomas Highland and the second act of Crime Classics and his report to you on the crime of Bathsheba Spooner. Listen to this. It's awful and dread, this tale that I tell. Joshua Spooner lies dead in a well in Brookfield Town in 78 from 6 stout whacks across the pate. Small poem by an anonymous contributor to the Worcester Spy, the local newspaper of the day. A change of scene now. Across the road from a cold well into a warm living room. Tableau, four people.
Mr. Spooner was such an elegant man. What will become of his clothes in his closet and his horse?
You may have them.
Come away from the window, Bathsheba. Here, to me, close.
The stars are dancing.
You're shivering. Are you cold?
No.
Will is very weary, Widow Spooner. We'll not go on to Worcester tonight.
Then wait till morning. You can make a place for yourselves in the barn.
But the money we'll have now, and the clothes and the horse.
Yes, all of it. Ezra.
Yes?
In the morning, you will go to Cooley's Tavern. Inquire of Joshua. Tell them he's not been home. Tell them I'm frantic for his welfare.
Yes.
Good night, gentlemen. A very good night.
Cooley.
Aye?
Had Grogan a nippy morning, Mr. Ross?
I've been sent to inquire of Joshua Spooner.
Who sent you?
The wife of him, Bathsheba.
Did she now? And why?
Last night he did not return home, and Mrs. Spooner is frantic for his welfare.
Not home? Well, he's not here. Last night he sat right there, my lad, and discussed military strategies with the doctor. Then, to the best of my knowledge, he went home.
Dr. King. Doctor. Doctor, wake. Wake up. Please, Doctor, wake up. It's important.
What is it? What?
Where is Joshua Spooner?
Where is he?
Mr. Cooley says he sat with you last night.
Yes, he did. And left me.
He's not home.
What?
Mrs. Spooner sent me to fetch him. She's troubled that he's not returned.
But where else could he have gone if not to his wife?
We must find him, Doctor.
Yes, by all means.
Ezra did that very well, with the precise shading of alarm in his voice, the concern. A man on an errand for a troubled lady. Everybody was impressed. Mr. Cooley closed his bar. Dr. King appealed to the neighborliness of the other customers, and everybody went looking for Joshua Spooner. Immediately, they called on Mrs. Spooner, whom they found in the greatest apparent distress. Upon an examination of the premises, in the neighborhood of the doorstep, they observed the tracks of several persons on the snow. And on further search, they found Mr. Spooner. You know where? In the well. So far, only horror and suspicions. But now, let's pick up Willie and James. They haven't left Brookfield. Stupid of them, isn't it? But then you've got to examine it from their point of view. Why become soldiers in Washington's army, especially in the winter, and suffer the privations of the military, when they could be warm and rich as a civilian? So, imagine it. Two tatterdemalion deserters, suddenly elegant, in Mr. Spooner's clothes, which were somewhat tight-fitting. But elegance and tight-fitting are somehow akin. Now, there lived in Brookfield a certain wench whose name is lost in history. This much is known about her. She had an eye for tight elegance. This much is known about her, too, that she went riding with Willie and James on their newly acquired horse.
I left you down.
Now, James, no.
Give us a bus, dearie. That's a dearie.
Will?
Aye.
How is it we are riding Mr. Spooner's horse?
Why, dearie, we don't know a Mr. Spooner.
Aren't these Mr. Spooner's silver buckles?
No.
Aren't you wearing his clothes?
These are our clothes, dearie. Come, let's ride some more. It brings the pink to your pretty cheeks.
But the cat was out of the bag. The girl told her mother, and her mother her father. And it so happened that her father was at that moment on his way to look for the murderers of Joshua Spooner. So the father told some neighbors, and they located James and Willie. Brought them all together. The two deserters, Ezra and Bathsheba. And this is what happened.
The jurors for the government and people of Massachusetts Bay in New England upon their oath present that William Brooks and James Buchanan and Ezra Ross in the county of Essex, not having God before their eyes, an assault did make upon Joshua Spooner, feloniously, willfully, and of their malice aforethought, on the first day of March last past, with force and arms also by striking, beating, and kicking aforesaid Joshua Spooner, so as to inflict several mortal bruises, of which Joshua Spooner died. And that Bathsheba Spooner, widow and late wife of Joshua Spooner, being seduced by the instigation of the devil, did incite, move, abet, counsel, and procure the murder of aforesaid Joshua Spooner. How do you plead?
Not guilty.
Not guilty?
Not guilty.
What statement have you, Bathsheba Spooner?
I am the wife of the deceased. If what you accuse me of be true, what end could the death of my husband serve? Were there any reasons, persuading, hopes, inviting, or advantages arising from the death of my husband? By depriving myself of husband, I would subject myself to the burdens of a widow. If I hated my husband, as such has been said, could I not have separated from him, gone to my father or to my brother? What foolishness is this to say I've loved Ezra Ross, when one of my station might have any gallant I please? Gentlemen, if I be guilty, I was not of sound mind.
the sheriff of our county of Essex. Greetings. We command you that on Thursday, the 4th day of June next, between the hours of 12 and 4 of the clock in the afternoon, you cause William Brooks, James Buchanan, Ezra Ross, and Bathsheba Spooner to be conveyed from our jail, where they are now in your custody, to the usual place of execution, and there to be hanged by the neck until their bodies be dead.
The motive, the crime, and the sentence. Justice was simple. And quickly, too quickly for the four prisoners, the 4th day of June. This is a copy of the Worcester Spy dated that day that I have here. I'd like to read from it. It was about 2:30 of the clock in the afternoon when the four criminals were brought out of prison and conducted to the place of execution under a guard of 100 men. The three men went on foot. Mrs. Spooner was carried in a chaise, being then, as she had been for several days, exceedingly feeble. The procession was regular and solemn. Just before they reached the place of execution, one of the most terrific thunderstorms that had occurred within the memory of the oldest inhabitant darkened the heavens. There followed an awful time. The loud shouts of the officers amidst the crowd of 5,000 people, the horses pressing upon those in front, the shrieks of the women in the tumult and confusion, the malefactors slowly advancing to the fatal tree, preceded by the dismal coffins, the fierce coruscations of the lightning athwart the darkened horizon, quickly followed by loud peals of thunder, conspired together and produced a dreadful scene of horror. It seemed as if the author of nature had added such terrors to the punishment of the criminals as might soften the stoutest heart of the most obdurate and abandoned. At length, the place of execution having been reached, Ross, Buchanan, and Brooks ascended the ladder to the stage.
Our which art in heaven, hallowed be thy name.
Ross made an audible prayer. The other two were engaged in silent devotions until they faced the noose. Mrs. Spooner, as she approached the tree, was seen to bow gracefully to many of the spectators with whom she had been acquainted. Then she crept up the ladder on her hands and knees. When the eyes of the malefactors were covered and all was ready, Mrs. Spooner took the sheriff by the hand. And for the first time, Bathsheba Spooner accepted the verdict of justice.
My dear sir, I am ready. In a little time, I expect to be in bliss. And but a few years must elapse when I hope I shall see you and my other friends again.
That's the way the newspaper recorded it. This has been my report of the crime of Bathsheba Spooner, the first woman tried and executed for murder in the United States.
Bathsheba Spooner, tonight's crime classic, was adapted from the original court reports and newspaper accounts by Morton Fine and David Friedkin. The music was composed and conducted by Bernard Herrmann, and the program was produced and directed by Elliot Lewis. Thomas Highland is portrayed on radio by Lou Merrill. Bathsheba Spooner was played by Mary Jane Croft. The cast included Herb Butterfield, Sam Edwards, William Johnstone, Georgia Ellis, Tudor Owen, and Ben Wright. Bob Luman speaking. And remember, for mystery mixed with merriment, join Mr. and Mrs. North Tuesday evenings on the CBS Radio Network.
Oh, okay, we're going to take a quick break here now, but we'll be back real soon.
Borexo waterless hand cleaner really cleans up for us. Just a dab. Removes paint, grease, tar, carbon, ink, even plain dirt. Anytime, anywhere, without water. The whole crew swears by Borexo waterless, and so will you.
By the way, as far as I can tell, no names were changed to protect the innocent or the guilty in that thing. Look, there's quite a bit of information on the web relating to this particular crime. The details that were covered in this radio presentation seem to be pretty accurate. I mean, you can Google it for yourself. Just Google Bathsheba Spooner, and you'll come up with a wealth of information. Or, if you want, you can go to the show notes at the website, www.nighttransmissions.com, no space between the night and the transmissions. And there, in the show notes for this show, show 44, in segment 1, which is devoted to this show, I've linked to the Wikipedia article. So, whatever's best, whatever's easiest for you. I might point out, however, that there is other ancillary material in the show notes, and the website is generally worth a visit. So then, what's next, huh? Well, what's next is an episode of the Canadian series Nightfall, Welcome to Homerville, from July 18th of 1980, in which a trucker, R.C. O'Connor by name, makes a detour into Homerville. Well, what can I say? It ain't Margaritaville, that's for sure.
In the dream, you are falling, lost in the listening distance, as dark locks in. Nightfall. Good evening. Tonight's story has a definite destination. I hope you're still with us when we get there. The play is called Welcome to Homerville.
It's a long way to go, and the road ahead is troubled. But this old break and me, we're gonna make it. Through the wind and rain and thunder, till the stormy skies are blue, and the sunlight lights the highway, heading home. It's a long, lonesome road, through the lifetime of a trucker. But this old truck and me, we're gonna make it. Yeah, me and this good old friend, we're gonna make it.
Hey, my friendlies, that was good old country boy C.W. McCall. Just a moving and grooving on down that long, lonesome road. Shaking the time to just 20 minutes on the shy side of midnight right here on WQRN, the big voice of country music in the Wolverine State. By the way, baby, if you are driving by a church, you just slow down here, because you just might see a bunch of folks building an ark. Because we are in for a motherload of rain early this 8 a.m. And while I'm warming up motherloads, here's a little mother I would just dearly love to get loaded with. Miss Tammy Wynette running us up to 18 minutes on the left-hand side of the hour. Go. Do it. Do it, Tammy.
Sometimes it's hard to be a woman, giving all your love to just one man.
Still with us. Well, the writers responsible for this latest excursion are Don Dickinson and Alan Gutman. Pleasant journey.
Stand by your man. Give him your heart to hold.
Yeah, this is the one, Georgia Strait. I'm at the back door of an 18-wheeler with Big Apple plates. You got your ears on there, good buddy. Come on.
This is KXR 0461. I hear you back there, Georgia Strait, and I've got you in my mirrors. Go.
Yeah, that's four for sure there. Just wanted a job there, good buddy. What's your handle? Come on.
This is Paper Pusher, Georgia Strait. Where are you headed? Come back.
I'm on the rebound from the Nickel City Holland Stale Air there. Left a load of Texas strawberries, took a busted sidewalk to Motown, rub eyeballs with a snuff dipper. First sergeant finds out, all big greasy side up. Come on.
Georgia Strait.
You go, good buddy.
What the hell are you talking about? Over.
Damned if I know. I think I said I left my shoes in Kansas. Come on.
I tell you what. Why don't we just talk straight, over?
I won't tell anyone if you won't. You been out long there, come on?
Yeah, it's my third day. You know this neck of the woods at all? I've never been up this way before. Over.
Yeah, I've been known to cruise these boonies. Smoke can get pretty thick up here. Come on.
Hey, I asked for a straight. Go.
I do apologize, Paper Pusher. But what I mean is that the Smokies, I mean the cops, come down pretty hard on speeders hereabouts. Come on.
No sweat. I'm in no hurry. I got a load of newsprint on. It can't go bad. Listen, is there a stop hereabouts? Go.
Why, you gotta shake hands with Shorty? Come on.
I hope you don't talk to your mother with that mouth. I'm trying to tell you I'm hungry. Come on.
Yeah, that's definitely a four for sure. Now there's a chew and choke in about 10 miles. Sorry, I can't join you for a cup of road tar, but this is my exit coming up. Where'd you say you were headed? Come on.
Well, I didn't say. I'm headed for Homerville. Have I got the best route? Over. Georgia Strait, do you read me? Over.
Did you say Homerville? Come on.
Right, Homerville. Over.
Homerville? You gotta be crazy. You heard them stories?
Stories? Now, what stories, go?
There's a turn back right now before you get there.
What?
You ain't never gonna get there on one piece.
Come in, Georgia Strait. Over.
You gotta turn back now while you can.
What the hell was all that about?
Sure, that's what the police say. But it don't make sense to me.
Well, somebody told me one of his front tires was bald as a baby's bum. Must have blown out.
No way. I rode with Norm for 2 years. Nobody took better care of his rig than him. Ask me.
Roy, did you have the special?
No, that's me, Matt. Thanks.
You get the cabbage roll.
Yeah.
Sorry to keep you waiting. Will it be?
Well, what's he have? Looks pretty good.
Cabbage rolls?
Yeah, I guess.
As an elf?
Well, bring me a copy, huh? Make it black.
It's on its way.
Say, Roy, did Norm have any family?
Oh, a wife, no kids. Separate.
Oh, yeah?
Ah, you know. Too many hours on the road?
Usual.
Sounds familiar.
I don't know. Still doesn't add up.
Here you go. One cabbage roll.
Yeah, thanks.
Say, buddy. You sure you want to eat those things?
I think I can handle them.
Pearl, just let the man eat.
Oh, sorry, mister.
No, no problem.
I seen you here before?
No, never been up this way. Oh, by the way, my name's R.C.
Hi, I'm Roy, and the food expert here is Earl.
Glad to know you. Which way you headed?
I'm hauling newsprint up to Homerville.
Homerville? Wasn't that where they found Norm?
Yeah, yeah. Homerville, huh? That's quite a ways from here.
Bad road up there.
Yeah? What do you mean?
Well, there's been a lot of accidents up that way.
Bad ones.
Well, I'll take it easy. I'm in no rush.
No one waiting back home?
Well, yeah, my wife. But I've been driving a long time. She's used to waiting.
Take it from me. They never get used to it.
Anything else here?
No, that's fine. God, look at the time. You got a phone here? Said I'd call home hours ago.
Yep. It's over in the corner.
Yeah, well, thanks.
That'll be $2.95.
Oh, right. Well, listen, here's 10. I'll be right back. See you guys in a few minutes. Hmm?
Sure.
Tell her you miss her cooking.
Operator.
I want to make a collect call to area code 555. The number is 486-7934.
What is your name, sir?
Just say it's R.C.
One moment, please. I'm sorry, sir. I am not getting an...
Hello?
I don't know. It's 1 o'clock, for God's sake. I have a collect call for anyone from R.C. Would you accept the charges?
R.C.? Sure.
Go ahead, sir.
Did I wake you, honey?
Yeah. Oh, no. No, I was just watching Johnny Carson. Hey, why are you calling? Something wrong?
No, I'm okay. I just thought I'd give you a call, see how you're doing.
I'm fine. You on your way home?
No, it's going to take longer than I thought. Probably won't make it back till Saturday.
Oh. Too bad.
Yeah. I tell you what, why don't I pick you up after work and we'll go to a show or something?
Hmm? Won't you be too tired, honey? Last time you went to a show.
No, really. I want to.
Well, sure. That'll be just fine.
So, what'd you do today?
What? Oh, not much. Slow day, you know. Knocked off early.
Hey, Rosie. Are you okay? You sound a little... I don't know.
R.C., I'm tired. It's late, you know?
Sorry. I meant to phone you earlier, but I was making good time.
Oh, damn it.
What was that?
Just something on TV.
That didn't sound like...
It was the TV.
Okay.
Look, R.C., it's late. I gotta get up early.
Sure. Okay.
See you Saturday.
Yeah. I'll pick you up, remember?
Oh, yeah. Well, look, you have a good trip.
Okay. Rose, you miss me?
Hey, mister, here's your change.
Hmm?
Oh, forget it. You keep it.
Breaker 19, this is KXRO461, the paper pusher. Anybody want to give me a shout, come on. This is the paper pusher. Anybody out there want to give me a nickel's worth, go.
Breaker, this is NSU 2496, Grand Falls Beacon.
I got you wall-to-wall, paper pusher. One or two to fat. Over.
Roger. Where you headed, Beacon? Go.
Well, I was heading to the kitchen for a sandwich till I heard your call. Come on.
Now, that must be some kind of rig you're driving. Over.
Oh, yeah? It's a two-story split level. Good on gas, though. Over.
Base station, huh? That's great. I don't get much chance to talk to many of you desk jockeys, just other high riders. You done any driving yourself, Go?
Oh, sure have, but not lately. Where you headed, paper pusher? Over.
I'm bound for Homerville. Over.
Where? Throw that back at me again. Go.
Homerville. Ever hear of it? Over.
I'll never forget it. Listen, good buddy, how long you been on the road today, Go?
Well, I guess I'm looking at 15, 16 hours, but traffic's light, so I've been trying to push through. Over.
Where are you now, paper pusher? Over.
Route 25, just past 113. Why? Come back.
Well, you're heading into a bad stretch of road.
What do you mean?
You got about 100 miles to go. What I mean is it might be easier to take after a night's sleep. The mind can do strange things when you're on a long haul. It's a lonely life. Sometimes we need someone riding beside us, someone to talk to, someone to turn to when danger threatens. Find you're not alone.
Breaker, breaker, Beacon, are you reading me? Over.
Since Homerville, I put my life in God's hands. Funny, the way my sight can let me see.
Breaker, Beacon, I'm losing you. Over.
Don't be led into temptation. Don't listen to that voice.
Beacon, didn't copy that. Please repeat. Over. Hey, is anybody out there?
Hey, by golly, it's Miss Dolly Parton. Yeah, and her big two doors down. Anybody don't like that little lady just don't like chicken on Sunday. It's coming on 3 in the a.m. right here on WQRN, the big voice of country music in the Wolverine State. And time. And time for one last look at the weather. I'll bet you're just hoping for a nice day today.
Oh, it better be.
Yeah, warm and sunny with a big blue sky.
Yeah, I'll take a dozen.
Yeah, well, you better move it on down to Florida, my man, because the rain's going to come down like a son of a gun with temperatures in the low 50s.
Damn.
You know, baby, I sit here and wonder just who's out there listening to WQRN at this hour. Up late, can't sleep, out on the road. Yeah, man, hey, take a look at the car up ahead of you, baby. I'll bet you he's listening to WQRN, too. You got something in common and you don't even know it. Tell you what, my man, why don't you just give him a little honk?
You gotta be kidding.
Come on, baby, don't be shy. I'm gonna give you a couple of seconds here. What the hell? Now, don't that feel better?
I feel like a fool. There's nobody out here.
You are with WQRN, top of the charts in country music.
So play something, will you?
WQRN now concludes its broadcast day. Our studios are located at 1063 Lombard Street and operate at an assigned frequency. And... damn it.
Breaker 19, breaker 19. Anybody out there? Come on. Anybody out there? Over.
Now, what's the use? So, good night until we say good morning.
It isn't much further now, I see. Why, you're almost there.
Jesus!
Hey, you okay?
Huh?
Yeah, a bit shaky. Well, that's better.
Fill her up?
Yeah, should take about 40.
You got it.
You scared the fenders off that guy up there.
Huh?
Wasn't enough daylight between you two to light a match.
Oh, yeah, I guess it was kind of close.
Close? You get that close to a woman, you could get her in trouble. What, you doze off?
No,
yeah,
I was just
listening to the radio. Yeah, that's how it usually happens.
Well, it's a matter of
fact. Yeah, I know. I've heard it all before.
It was the damnedest thing.
Yeah. Now, trouble with your old lady, too much time on the road. And maybe she's playing around and you wish you were. Did you check your oil?
No, it's fine.
How did
Ed
you...
Ed Vomer, aren't you? Yeah, how did you know?
All in newsprint.
Yeah?
Now, don't look at me cockeyed, boy. You can smell that stuff a mile away. You got quite a drive ahead of you, 200 miles. Here we go. Didn't take that much after all.
How much do I owe you?
Read it and weep.
Now, hold it. Did you say 200 miles?
Well, it ain't been 200 miles to Homerville long as I can remember. Unless they moved it. You want a receipt?
Yeah, okay.
Seems kind of a waste to fill her up.
200 miles? Does that go anyway? Two doors down, getting drunk and having a party. Two doors down. Breaker, this is KXR 0461. Anybody home? Come on. Anybody there? No. Stand by your man. And that was the paper pusher heading down that long, lonesome road. 25 minutes on the far side of 4 o'clock on KXR 0461. Voice of country music here in the Wolverine State. That's a Wolverine. It's request night here on Route 40, so give us a call and we'll play your favorite tune. Any requests, neighbors?
Y'all come to me. It's really not much further now.
What? Who the hell is that? Come on now. Answer me.
You're almost here. Hurry on now, Archie. Just a little further.
Who are you? What do you want?
It's taken you so long to get here. And I'm waiting on you. I'm waiting.
Waiting? What do you mean, waiting for me? Where are you?
Oh, I'm close, I see. Why, I'm almost close enough to touch.
What are you trying to do to me? What the hell am I doing?
You want to step out of the cab, please?
Are you there? Are you still there?
Come on, pal. Get out of that cab.
Sure, right away. Look, officer, I know it looks like I've been drinking or something.
It had crossed my mind.
I guess I was moving at a pretty good clip.
For a plane, no. For a truck, yes. Like to have a look at your license.
Yeah, well, here you go.
Thanks. Well, Mr. O'Connor, would you mind standing with your legs apart and your arms out to the side, please?
Oh, but you don't understand.
Mr. O'Connor, you'll make it easier on both of us if you just do it.
Okay.
Would you place your right index finger on your nose, please? Now your left.
I wasn't drinking.
Is this your vehicle?
Yeah, I lease it.
You have the papers, please?
Yeah, they're in the cab.
May I see them, please?
Look, I'm trying to tell you. I was getting a signal on my CB.
On your CB? What kind of signal? What did you hear?
Well, it was a woman's voice.
Was it? Look, you looked like you could use some sleep. Were you planning to take a break?
No. I was trying to push on through tonight.
Well, Connor, I've seen a lot of guys in your condition. Take it from me, you'd be better off getting a little rest. You find a motel 2 miles up the road. If I were you, I'd stop there and get some sleep. You got more than 200 miles to go. If you ever want to see Homerville...
Homerville? Oh, wait! How did you... If I ever want to see it...
Can you make it to the truck, buddy? Get you to a doctor.
Buck, I can't move.
Can you hang on? I'll go get help.
She was here. She was right in the car.
She... Was there someone with you? Where?
Someone...
Hang on. Hang on. I'll go get help.
Gray, Channel 9. We've got a 1034. Mayday. This is KXRO 461. Over. Mayday. Mayday, a 1034. Can anybody hear me? Over.
Yeah, I hear you, Archie.
You'll get off this channel.
Oh, my. You're so close, Archie.
Stop it. Yeah, stop it. Leave me alone.
You're almost here.
Leave me alone.
At last. Here we...
You have just heard Welcome to Homerville by Alan Gutman and Don Dickinson. Neil Denard was featured as R.C. O'Connor, with Jimmy Morris as the announcer, John Stocker as Georgia Strait, Frank Perry and Robert Christie as Roy and Earl, Corinne Langston as Betty the waitress, Marion Waldman as the telephone operator, and Elva Mae Hoover as Rosie. You also heard Ron Hartman as Beacon, Arch McDonald as the gas station attendant, Bud Knapp as the highway cop, Gordon Thompson as the injured motorist, and Lynn Darragon as the siren. Our recording engineer is Ray Falsick, with sound effects by Bill Robinson. The senior script editor is John Douglas, and our production assistant is Doris Buchanan. Nightfall is produced and directed for CBC Radio by Bill Howell.
Ellery Queen's Minute Mysteries. This is Ellery Queen with the case I call the Deep Sea Murder. When a young scuba diver was found murdered, his equipment tampered with, it appeared to be the work of a fellow diver. I questioned him at length. I don't think you can prove I did anything to his equipment, he said confidently. Besides, I rather think he panicked in the deep water and tried to get to the surface in a hurry. Sounds like a good alibi, doesn't it? It was for a while, I replied, but you're guilty of murder. In a moment, I'll tell you why.
Oh, okay, we're going to take a quick break here now, but we'll be back real soon.
Murder, the suspect knew you cannot surface quickly from a deep dive. His statement that the victim tried to get to the surface in a hurry proved his guilt. He shouldn't have made that statement. He hasn't made many more either. Listen again to Ellery Queen's Minute Mysteries.
Last week in show 43, I ran the escape adaptation of the Ray Bradbury story, The Earthman, and mentioned that Escape had only ever adapted two stories from Ray Bradbury's The Martian Chronicles, The Earthman, and this next one on June 2nd of 1950, Mars is Heaven. In show 8, we did the Dimension X version. There's also an X-1 version and several others out there. And so this may not be the last you will hear of Mars is Heaven.
Tired of the everyday routine? Ever dream of a life of romantic adventure? Want to get away from it all?
We offer you Escape. Escape. Designed to free you from the four walls of today for a half hour of high adventure.
Tonight, we escape to a gigantic rocket ship, about to be shocked into space on man's first voyage to Mars. As Ray Bradbury tells it in his famous science fiction story, Mars is Heaven.
The project is magnificent, overwhelming, and tremendous. We return you now to the scene of the takeoff in the desert of New Mexico. Go ahead, New Mexico.
Thank you, London. This is Stuart Novins back in New Mexico. I'm standing here on the great steel observation platform overlooking the takeoff stand. As the moment for departure draws nearer, the whole area has been flooded with artificial light. It bathes the spaceship in a kind of silver luminescence, and surrounding it, engulfing it, this subdued hysteria of hundreds of thousands of people come to see the start of this incredible voyage of 18 men in the rocket ship, the Venture. It's standing there pointing upward, pointing toward the heavens, and in a few minutes it will bloom out into great flowers of heat and color, shocked into space on man's first voyage to Mars. As you know, ladies and gentlemen, prayers are being said for these 18 men and their ship, the first men, the first ship to dare the voyage to another planet. Prayers are being said by every creed in mosques and churches and synagogues the world over. We take you now to the Basilica of St. Paul's in Rome. This is New Mexico again. We're sorry to cut in, but that roar you're hearing, the roar of a crowd, it's the moment we've been waiting for. I can see the crew of the Venture walking up the catwalk that leads to the spaceship. The men are entering, and now the escape hatch is closed. Now the men are in the ship. This silence, this great, awful silence of the crowd, it's the voiceless prayer that's in every heart. They're about ready now. Some lights from the ship just blinked on and off. It's a signal. In just a few seconds, a few more, stand by. Stand by. They're gone. The Venture. It's out of sight.
Log entry, U.S. rocket ship Venture. 1 hour out from Earth, destination Mars. Past Keneally Heaviside layer without incident. Rate of speed, 450,000 miles per hour. The planet Mars at its closest point to Earth, 35 million miles. Calculate duration of voyage to be roughly 3.5 days. Captain John Black, master. Log entry, U.S. rocket ship, The Venture. 12 hours out from Earth. While navigating supertension atmospheric forces, port shield generator broke down. Replaced by booster. Yes?
Lieutenant Lustig reporting, sir.
Come in, Pete.
Have a report on the trajectory, sir?
I'll put it on my desk. Pete?
Yes, sir.
How do you feel?
Feel? Huh. Just wonderful, sir. Sitting up there in an observation turret, I don't know just how to say it. The sights, I mean, moon so close and Earth looking like... And Mars, sir. Sir, do you really think we'll make it?
Who is it?
Dr. Hankson, Captain. May I come in?
Sure, Sam.
You want to sleep, were you, John?
Oh, Sam, just sitting here thinking.
Well, don't think about it too much. Sleep instead. Need all the sleep he can get.
Who sleeps? Who sleeps and has no way of knowing what's waiting for him? Look at it through the porthole, Sam. Mars. How would you describe it, that glittering blob of red?
That's good enough.
Will it consume us? Spew our dust out into space? Maybe it's the Elysian fields, all charm and sweetness and moonlight shining on the restless dead. Which will it be, Sam?
I don't know. All I know is that they told me I was an expert in space medicine. At Randolph Field on a plot of ground called Texas, they told me that. That's all I know.
What are you doing up? You're supposed to be in the sack.
Well, I'll tell you, Captain. Sometimes a man can't sleep. That happens to me sometimes. So I just wander through the ship, check on the boys, see that they're tucked in properly.
That's what you were doing with me, huh?
No.
What made them do it, Sam? What made them volunteer?
Man keeps looking for something. There are no new frontiers now, only new worlds. And there'll always be men who want to conquer them.
Log entry, U.S. rocket ship Venture. 78 hours out from Earth. Approaching gravitational field of Mars. Atmospheric conditions similar to Earth's. Log entry, U.S. rocket ship Venture. 79 hours out from Earth. Have this moment landed on Mars at 1700 hours. We made it. Chemical analysis indicated on ship's instrument shows air to be breathable and will sustain human life. Gravity comparable with that of Earth's.
Ready, John?
Yes. Hold it on the sick bay, Sam.
Happy? They're all right, John. You ready?
First one thing. Captain to crew, your attention. We have landed on Mars. No man is to leave this ship under penalty of court-martial. Dr. Hingston and I will make a brief reconnaissance. Crew will proceed with repair of ship's hull. As you know, our ship is armed against any possible aggression. I can't impress it upon you too strongly. No man will leave this ship until Dr. Hingston and I ascertain that we are not in a hostile world. That is all. Let's go, Sam.
You first, Captain. Your Honor. You, the first man from Earth to walk on Mars.
This grass. It's a well-kept lawn.
John, look over there. A house. A Victorian house. Colored glass and scrolls and everything.
I don't believe it. Come on. Sam, look at these. Two iron deer on this lawn. We had a pair of these when I was a kid. Sam, did you hear that? That,
That cattle from that house. Sam, this isn't Mars. It can't be. It just can't be.
It can't be, John, but it is. Welcome to Mars.
What did I say, Sam? Somewhere back there in space? That Mars was the Elysian Fields, all sweetness and charm.
No, John, it isn't that. It's what you see. A world like ours on Earth.
And this?
A small town with good air in it. A small town like the one I was born in. Same smell of flowers, the same sound.
You think that the civilizations of two planets can progress at the same rate, develop in the same way?
I do now.
Well, I don't. Well, look at that house. A Victorian house on Mars? You expect me to believe that? A house with lace curtain windows, with port swings, with something that sounds like a piano and probably is a piano, playing beautiful Ohio. You believe all that?
I believe it. I admit it's strange, but I believe it.
Strange nuts. It's impossible. We're going back to the ship.
Wait, John. It could be. It could be that there are similar patterns of thought, movement, civilization on every planet in our system. Maybe we're on the threshold of the great psychological and metaphysical discovery of our time. Maybe we...
Well, go on, Sam.
Maybe this proves the existence of God.
Not everyone needs proof.
I don't. But how else can you explain all this? Johnny, it fills me with terror and joy. I don't know whether to laugh or cry.
I admit it looks peaceful and cool. Pretty much like Council Bluffs, where I was born. That was a good, quiet place, Council Bluffs, Iowa.
Do you see that, Sam? Do you hear it?
I see it and hear it. It's there. A horse and carriage going down the street.
Suppose that by accident or something, we landed on a planet in space in another time. Suppose that this is Earth, 30 or 50 years ago. Maybe we got lost in the dimensions. What do you think, Sam?
So much like my hometown. That house. That room up there with the beaded lamp near the window. When I was a kid, I used to sleep and do my lessons in a room just like that. I'd lie there in the night, and I'd be awake, and I could hear the freight trains across the river, and... John, do you hear that?
I hear. Let's go.
Where?
We're going up to that house and ask questions. Where else? Come on.
Yes, can I help you?
I beg your pardon, but we want...
If you're selling something, I'm much too busy and I haven't time. We're all at supper.
Oh, wait, don't go. What town is this?
What do you mean, what town is this? How could you be in a town and not know what town it was?
Oh, I beg your pardon, but we're strangers here. We're from Earth, and we want to know... How this town got here? How you got here?
Are you census taker?
No.
Well, what do you want, then?
How long has this town been here?
It was built in 1868. Is this a game?
Oh, no, not a game. Look, try to understand. We're from Earth.
From where?
From Earth.
Where's that?
The Earth? What?
Out of the ground, you mean?
Oh, no, from the planet Earth. Come out on the porch, please, and I'll show you.
No, I won't come out there. You're evidently quite mad from the sun.
Let me try, John. Lady, we came in a flying ship across space among the stars. We came from the third planet from the sun, Earth, to this planet, which is Mars. Now, do you understand?
You're touched from the sun, too. Go away now before I call my husband from his supper. He'll beat you up. That's what he'll do.
But this is Mars, isn't it?
This is Green Lake, Ohio, on the continent of America, surrounded by the Pacific and Atlantic Oceans on a place called the World, or sometimes the Earth. Go away now, go away!
Let's take a walk, Sam.
Yeah.
Sam?
Yeah?
There's something going on here. Something we don't understand. I want you to go back to the ship. If anything out of the way happens, lift the ship and get out.
But, John...
That's an order, Sam.
All right, if it's an order. John, look. Look at that woman walking toward us.
What about her?
Well, she looks like...
Sam! Oh, Sam, you look fine. You're grown up. Sam, don't you know me? It's your grandma, your old grandma.
grandmother.
What's wrong, Sam? This is a happy meeting. And who is this friend of yours?
This is Captain John Black. John, this is my grandmother.
Grandmother?
So help me. So help me, John. This is my grandmother. She's dead. Died 30 years ago. But this is my grandmother.
Well, there's no sense standing here on the street. You just come along to my house. We've so much to talk about. You too, Captain. And a friend of my grandson's is mine, too. Now, don't stand there with your mouths open. Come on. Here, Sam, have some more iced tea. Would you like some more, too, Captain?
Oh, thank you. I would.
Well, here's to our health.
Health? How long have you been here, Grandmother?
Ever since I died.
What?
Don't look like that. I said ever since I died, 30 years ago.
Sam.
Who are we to question what happens? What's living, anyway? All I know is I'm alive again and no questions asked. Here, Captain Field. Go ahead and feel my arm. Solid, isn't it? You hear my voice, don't you? You hear it, don't you, Captain?
Yes, yes, I hear it. Grandmother.
Well, then why go around questioning?
Well, it's just that we... I never thought I'd see you again, Grandmother.
Mrs. Hingston.
Yes, tomorrow I'll see Captain.
Oh, no. I just want to ask you a question. Mrs. Hingston, is Mars heaven?
Nonsense. No. It's a world, and we get a second chance. It's like another Earth. How do we know there wasn't one before Earth?
That's a good question, John.
Well, maybe we better get back to the ship, Sam. It's been nice, Mrs. Hingston. Thanks for the drink.
You'll be back, of course. For supper, I mean. We're having fried chicken
and
nice potatoes.
Wait a minute. What's that? Excuse me, Mrs. Hingston.
Sam? Come here.
Hey, well, what do you know, John? A parade. With a brass band.
But the crew. My crew marching behind the band with all those people.
But they're heroes. These people are welcoming them as heroes.
The abandoned ship. They had orders. I'll court-martial every one of them.
Oh, John, listen to me. They found all relatives and friends just like I have.
They have their orders.
What would you have done?
Obeyed orders. I...
What's the matter? Sam, I don't believe it. It's impossible.
John, they said I would find you here.
Yes.
Of course, darling.
Phyllis.
Of course. Who did you think it was?
This is Phyllis, Sam. My 10 years ago. After that, I never got married.
We're waiting for you. Your mother and father.
They're alive?
Waiting for you. At your old house. On Maple Avenue.
You heard that, Sam, didn't you? This is Phyllis talking. And she said mother and dad and the house...
You understand it now. The crew. Same thing has happened to them.
Yes. Yes. When I open my eyes, it'll all be gone. Phyllis will be gone.
Open them, John.
Phyllis.
Oh, my darling. My darling.
Good to see you children dancing together again. Your mother would have enjoyed it so much, John.
I must have worn her out with all my questions.
Don't worry about it, son. She'd get a good rest tonight. Then in the morning, the days after, we have so much time now, son. We'll all be together. You and Phyllis, your mother and I. So much time.
Yes, yes.
Please don't go away from me, John. Hold me closer. I've dreamed so long of dancing with you. No more questions. Just accept that your mother and father were once dead and are now alive. That I was killed. 10 years ago, I was killed in a horrible accident. And now I'm alive and in your arms. Oh,
tight, John. Hold me tight.
I'll run along to bed now. You children won't forget to turn out the lights. Well, you know what to do. Good night, Phyllis.
Good night, Father Black.
Good night, son.
Good night, Dad.
Shall we go out on the back porch, John? Like we used to long ago. Come with me, John. Here. Let's sit here on the steps. Remember that great arbor? You built it. I remember you hit your thumb with a hammer, and I cried. You're very silent, John. Is anything wrong?
Phyllis, I just had a crazy notion. Suppose this were Mars.
But it isn't.
Humor me, Phyllis. Suppose it were Mars. And the Martians saw our ship coming and saw us inside our ship and hated us, and they wanted to destroy us, but in a very clever way.
Yes.
Well, what would be the best weapon a Martian could use against us with our atomic bombs, our hydrogen...
John...
Now, let me finish. The hypothesis is interesting. The Martians would use telepathy, hypnosis, memory, imagination.
Oh, John, don't question us anymore. No more.
But suppose this town is some other shape, a Martian shape. But by playing on my memory and my desires and my wants, they've made it what I've wanted it to be.
Yes.
I suppose my mother and father weren't that at all. But two Martians, incredibly brilliant, keeping me under this dreaming hypnosis, as other Martians have done it to my men, to Sam.
But me, you've had your arms around me. You've kissed me. We shared old secrets. Was that a Martian hypnosis, John?
Phyllis...
Yes, what is it, John? Where are you going?
I've got to talk to Sam. I've got to find out what he thinks now that he's alone with his grandmother.
Stay here with me, John.
Well, I've got to talk to Sam. Maybe he's beginning to wonder, too.
You're not going anywhere, John.
Phyllis!
Phyllis, no! You're not Phyllis! I was right! You're not...
Friends, comrades, fellow Martians, this is a great day for Mars, a day of great rejoicing. As number one of Quadrant 327B of Sector Q, it is my proud privilege to read to you this message from the Planetary All-High. It says, congratulations on your splendid work in meeting the barbarian invaders and atomizing them. You have proven the complete efficiency of Plan A, and hereafter, mass hypnosis will become standard operating procedure in repelling any further invasion from outer space, be they sub-Martian from Earth or any other creature from any other planet. Well done. I can add little to this unstinted praise from the All-High, but I would like to point out to you that what you have accomplished could not have been done had it not been for our space heroes who have risked so much and often given all in recent years to keep the planet Earth under close surveillance. This surveillance, as you know, has been accomplished by our space patrols, known to Earthmen as flying saucers. Ah, they were courageous, these Earth creatures, to brave space in that crude ship. But they were inferior beings, and therefore they had to be atomized. Their extinction was necessary to ensure our way of life. Yet perhaps, since this has been your first encounter with creatures from outer space, you whose glorious victory this has been, may want to say something. Is there anyone who wants to say something? You?
Well, yes. It was a very interesting experience. He said his name was John Black. He was a nice young being. Nice. He thought I was his father, whatever that is. I guess that's all I want to say.
And you?
No, I don't think so. Well, I thought of something, but I forgot.
I see. And you?
One of them asked me if Mars was heaven. What's heaven?
I don't know. Now for the business at hand. The ship. The ship they came in. The destruction of it. Disintegrator squad.
Ready.
Proceed.
Compress charge. 16 atmospheres. Charges compressed. Low velocity. Trajectory 2. Low velocity. Trajectory 2. Release. Charge!
The ship they came in, it's gone.
Escape was produced and directed by William N. Robson. And tonight has presented Mars as Heaven by Ray Bradbury. Adapted for radio by Morton Fine and David Friedkin. Featured in the cast were Jeff Corey as Captain Black, Florence Bates as the grandmother, Bill Johnstone as Dr. Hingston, Walter Catlett as number one of Mars, Elizabeth Root as Phyllis, Paul Frees as Peter Lustig, Ian Wolfe as the father, and Stuart Novins, who played himself. Also heard were Ruth Parrott and Ben Wright. Special music arranged and played by Ivan Bitmars. This is CBS, the Columbia Broadcasting System.
Strange Adventure. Ed Coakley and Jim Travers rode into the boom town of Belmont, Nevada, and tied their horses in front of one of the saloons. It was evening, and they had ridden a long way for their merrymaking. The two cowboys had picked the right place. Belmont had all the rough pleasures that the West afforded. It was a rich town. The mines were producing at a fabulous rate, and each day people flocked here to gather some of the wealth. Among these were gamblers, card sharps, and horse thieves. Several days before the arrival of Ed and Jim, however, someone had stolen a batch of horses, and the citizens were gunning for the thieves. As the cowboys started into the saloon, a man came through the swinging doors. He stopped abruptly, looked intently at the strangers, and then, leveling his six gun at the pair, began to shout,
"Them's the ones! Hey, everybody! Hey, I done caught me some horse thieves!"
The sheriff came running with the others and took charge of the prisoners. He turned to the miner.
"Now, how do you know that these are the men?"
"Well, I saw them as they rode off the other night."
That was good enough for the crowd. They began to mill around and shout for a rope. The sheriff, not at all convinced of their guilt, put them into jail for their safety. Late that evening, they sat in their cell and considered their situation. It was serious, they knew. Outside, they could hear an angry mob. "What do you think, Jim? Will they try to take us out of here?"
"No, I don't think so."
Almost on the heels of these words came the ominous sound of a battering ram on the barred door of the jail. The door soon gave way, and willing hands held the sheriff as the two cowboys were dragged from their cell. Ed Coakley struggled in the hands of his captors.
"Look, give us time, will you? Give us time to prove we didn't do it."
The mob only jeered at him, and a voice in the crowd called out,
"Take him down to Big Jack's barn and hang him from the rafters down there."
The crowd roared its approval and moved off down the street. The rope had been thrown over a beam, and the noose adjusted around Jim Travers' neck. When he spoke, his first word since being taken a prisoner, and there was blood dripping from a cut on his head.
"Ed Coakley and me never stole no horses. If you hang us, you'll be hanging two innocent men."
The crowd paid no attention. They prepared for the lynching. Jim Travers straightened to his full height, and when he spoke again, he seemed to dominate the scene. He looked down at the spattered floor.
"As long as that blood shows, there'll be a curse on all of you. As long as it shows, this town will never prosper."
At that moment, the ropes came taut, and the two innocent cowboys were jerked off their feet to hang until dead. Before the crowd moved away, a miner rushed into the room with bad news.
"See, you know what? The Collins mine has petered out."
That was the first. Soon there were others, and it wasn't long before all the mines had shut down. They had lost the motherlode, and Belmont, its support gone, went into a decline.
And today it stands a ghost town, deserted and alone, haunted by a bloodstain and a curse. This is Pat McGeehan saying goodbye for my writer Charles Crowder and inviting you to listen again to another tale of Strange Adventure.
Okay, one last break here and then we'll be right back. When I was young, which was a long time ago, by the way, one of my favorite authors was Alice Mary Norton. I didn't know her as Alice Mary Norton when I was young. I knew her as Andre Norton. A lot of the science fiction writers of that era hid their gender under pseudonyms. There were a few who didn't. But many did, and Alice Mary Norton was one such. Although later in her career, she never abandoned the Andre, but she did begin to write under the name Andre Alice Norton. I first encountered the work of Andre Norton in what must have been 1960, the year she published Storm Over Warlock. I still remember reading it and being quite impressed with it. In fact, it was one of the few books that I read more than once as a kid. Yeah, kid, 14, yeah, I was a kid. In fact, I was so impressed with Storm Over Warlock that I'm going to make it available to you, as well as the short story that we're going to play here in a little while. If you go to the website, www.nighttransmissions.com, and Night Transmissions is just one word, no space or underscore or anything between the night and the transmissions. As soon as you land, you'll notice on the left side a navigation menu. And on the navigation menu, one of the buttons will be labeled the shows. If you press that, that'll take you to a page which serves as an index for all the shows so far. If you click on show 44, which of course is this show, it'll take you to the show notes. If you scroll to the bottom, you'll find a section called Extras. It's in here that you will find links for the text version of Storm Over Warlock. And as a bonus, there's also a link for a LibriVox project audio version of Storm Over Warlock. There will be some other links there, too, to other works by Andre Norton. That's one of the things that I like to do here. One of the reasons that makes this thing worth doing is to be able to find these things and pass them along to anyone who cares to listen. I do this every show. Some shows have more than others. This time it'll be quite considerable, because there's a good deal of Alice Mary's work that has passed into public domain and has been published by the Gutenberg Project. Everything there is free, or has been read by the LibriVox Project, and everything there is free. So there's going to be links to all of this stuff. You may have noticed that I've been speaking of Alice Mary in the past tense. Well, that's kind of the sad thing about doing this, to discover that so many of the people who influenced me when I was young have passed on. That's another thing that when I was younger, I didn't use euphemisms like that. I just liked the use of euphemisms. People didn't pass on, they died, and I said they died. But now, in my 60s, I take a much gentler approach to euphemisms. Of course, doesn't make them any less dead, does it? Andre Norton passed on in 2005 at the age of 93. So, at least she lived a full and long life. Now, to get away from this somewhat sad note, I'm going to play
the audio version of Andre Norton's All Cats Are Gray, which was published in Fantastic Universe in the August-September issue of 1973. I meant 1953.
All Cats Are Gray. Reading by Greg Marguerite. Stina of the Spaceways. That sounds just like a corny title for one of the Stellar Veto spreads. I ought to know, I've tried my hand at writing enough of them. Only this Stina was no glamour babe. She was as colorless as a lunar plant. Even the hair nettled down to her skull had a sort of grayish cast, and I never saw her but once draped in anything but a shapeless and baggy gray spaceall. Stina was strictly background stuff, and that's where she mostly spent her free hours, in the smelly, smoky background corners of any stellar port dive frequented by free spacers. If you really looked for her, you could spot her, just sitting there listening to the talk, listening and remembering. She didn't open her mouth often, but when she did, spacers had learned to listen, and the lucky few who heard her rare spoken words, these will never forget Stina. She drifted from port to port, being an expert operator on the big calculators. She found jobs wherever she cared to stay for a time, and she came to be something like the masterminded machines she tended, smooth, gray, without much personality of her own. But it was Stina who told Bub Nelson about the Jovan moon rites, and her warning saved Bub's life 6 months later. It was Stina who identified the piece of stone Keene Clark was passing around a table one night, rightly calling it unworked slitite. That started a rush which made 10 fortunes overnight for men who were down to their last jets. And last of all, she cracked the case of the Empress of Mars. All the boys who had profited by her queer store of knowledge and her photographic memory tried at one time or another to balance the scales, but she wouldn't take so much as a cup of canal water at their expense, let alone the credits they tried to push on her. Bub Nelson was the only one who got around her refusal. It was he who brought her Bat. About a year after the Jovan affair, he walked into the freefall one night and dumped Bat down on her table. Bat looked at Stina and growled. She looked calmly back at him and nodded once. From then on, they traveled together, the thin gray woman and the big gray tomcat. Bat learned to know the inside of more stellar bars than even most spacers visit in their lifetimes. He developed a liking for vernal juice, drank it neat and quick, right out of the glass. And he was always at home on any table where Stina elected to drop him. This is really the story of Stina, Bat, Cliff Moran, and the Empress of Mars, a story which is already a legend of the spaceways. And it's a damn good story, too, I ought to know, having framed the first version of it myself. For I was there, right in the Ryle Royal, when it all began on the night that Cliff Moran blew in, looking lower than an ant-man's belly and twice as nasty. He'd had a spell of luck foul enough to twist a man into a slug snake, and we all knew that there was an attachment out for his ship. Cliff had fought his way up from the back courts of Venaport, lose his ship, and he'd slip back there, to rot. He was at the snarling stage that night when he picked out a table for himself and set out to drink away his troubles. However, just as the first bottle arrived, so did a visitor. Stina came out of her corner. Bat curled around her shoulders, stole-wise, his favorite mode of travel. She crossed over and dropped down without invitation at Cliff's side. That shook him out of his sulks, because Stina never chose company when she could be alone. If one of the manstones on Ganymede had come stumping in, it wouldn't have made more of us look out of the corners of our eyes. She stretched out one long-fingered hand and set aside the bottle he had ordered and said only one thing. "It's about time for the Empress of Mars to appear again." Cliff scowled and bit his lip. He was tough, tough as jet lining. You have to be granite inside and out to struggle up from Venaport to a ship command. But we could guess what was running through his mind at that moment. The Empress of Mars was just about the biggest prize a spacer could aim for. But in the 50 years she had been following her queer derelict orbit through space, many men had tried to bring her in, and none had succeeded. A pleasure ship carrying untold wealth, she had been mysteriously abandoned in space by passengers and crew, none of whom had ever been seen or heard of again. At intervals thereafter she had been sighted, even boarded. Those who ventured into her either vanished or returned swiftly without any believable explanation of what they had seen, wanting only to get away from her as quickly as possible. But the man who could bring her in, or even strip her clean in space, that man would win the jackpot. All right, Cliff slammed his fist down on the table. I'll try even that. Stina looked at him much as she must have looked at Bat the day Bub Nelson brought him to her, and nodded. That was all I saw. The rest of the story came to me in pieces months later, and in another port half the system away. Cliff took off that night. He was afraid to risk waiting, with a writ out that could pull the ship from under him. And it wasn't until he was in space that he discovered his passengers, Stina and Bat. We'll never know what happened then. I'm betting that Stina made no explanation at all. She wouldn't. It was the first time she had decided to cash in on her own tip, and she was there. That was all. Maybe that point weighed with Cliff. Maybe he just didn't care. Anyway, the three were together when they sighted the Empress, riding, her dead lights gleaming, a ghost ship in night space. She must have been an eerie sight because her other lights were on, too, in addition to the red warnings at her nose. She seemed alive, a Flying Dutchman of space. Cliff worked his ship skillfully alongside and had no trouble in snapping magnetic lines to her lock. Some minutes later, the three of them passed into her. There was still air in her cabins and corridors, air that bore a faint corrupt taint which set Bat to sniffing greedily and could be picked up even by the less sensitive human nostrils. Cliff headed straight for the control cabin, but Stina and Bat went prowling. Closed doors were a challenge to both of them, and Stina opened each as she passed, taking a quick look at what lay within. The fifth door opened on a room which no woman could leave without further investigation. I don't know who had been housed there when the Empress left port on her last lengthy cruise. Anyone really curious can check back on the old photo reg cards. But there was a lavish display of silks trailing out of two travel kits on the floor, a dressing table crowned with crystal and jeweled containers, along with other lures for the female which drew Stina in. She was standing in front of the dressing table when she glanced into the mirror, glanced into it, and froze. Over her right shoulder she could see the spider silk cover on the bed. Right in the middle of that sheer gossamer expanse was a sparkling heap of gems, the dumped contents of some jewel case. Bat had jumped to the foot of the bed and flattened out as cats will, watching those gems, watching them, and something else. Stina put out her hand blindly and caught up the nearest bottle. As she unstoppered it, she watched the mirrored bed. A gemmed bracelet rose from the pile, rose in the air and tinkled its siren song. It was as if an idle hand played. Bat spat almost noiselessly, but he did not retreat. Bat had not yet decided on his course. She put down the bottle. Then she did something which perhaps few of the men she had listened to through the years could have done. She moved without hurry or sign of disturbance on a tour about the room. And although she approached the bed, she did not touch the jewels. She could not force herself to that. It took her 5 minutes to play out her innocence and unconcern. Then it was Bat who decided the issue. He leaped from the bed and escorted something to the door, remaining a careful distance behind. Then he mewed loudly twice. Stina followed him and opened the door wider. Bat went straight on down the corridor, as intent as a hound on the warmest of scents. Stina strolled behind him, holding her pace to the unhurried gait of an explorer. What sped before them both was invisible to her, but Bat was never baffled by it. They must have gone into the control cabin almost on the heels of the unseen, if the unseen had heels, which there was good reason to doubt, for Bat crouched just within the doorway and refused to move on. Stina looked down the length of the instrument panels and officers' station seats to where Cliff Moran worked. On the heavy carpet her boots made no sound, and he did not glance up but sat humming through set teeth as he tested the tardy and reluctant responses to buttons which had not been pushed in years. To human eyes they were alone in the cabin, but Bat still followed a moving something with his gaze, and it was something with which he at last made up his mind to distrust and dislike. For now even he took a step or two forward and spat, his loathing made plain by every raised hair along his spine. And in that same moment Stina saw a flicker of vague outline against Cliff's hunched shoulders, as if the invisible one had crossed the space between them. But why had it been revealed against Cliff and not against the back of one of the seats or against the panels, the walls of the corridor, or the cover of the bed where it had reclined and played with its loot? What could Bat see? The storehouse memory that had served Stina so well through the years clicked open a half-forgotten door. With one swift motion, she tore loose her spaceall and flung the baggy garment across the back of the nearest seat. Bat was snarling now, emitting the throaty, rising cry that was his hunting song, but he was edging back, back towards Stina's feet, shrinking from something he could not fight, but which he faced defiantly. If he could draw it after him, past that dangling spaceall, he had to. It was their only chance. What the... Cliff had come out of his seat and was staring at them. What he saw must have been weird enough. Stina, bare-armed and shouldered, her usually stiffly nettled hair falling wildly down her back. Stina watching empty space with narrowed eyes and set mouth, calculating a single wild chance. Bat, crouched on his belly, retreating from thin air step by step and wailing like a demon. "Toss me your blaster," Stina gave the order calmly, as if they still sat at their table in the Rigel Royal. And as quietly, Cliff obeyed. She caught the small weapon out of the air with a steady hand, caught and leveled it. "Stay just where you are," she warned. "Back, Bat. Bring it back." With a last throat-splitting screech of rage and hate, Bat twisted to safety between her boots. She pressed the thumb and forefinger, firing at the spaceholes. The material turned to powdery flakes of ash, except for certain bits which still flapped from the scorched seat as if something had protected them from the force of the blast. Bat sprang straight up in the air with a scream that tore their ears. "What?" began Cliff again. Stina made a warning motion with her left hand. "Wait." She was still tense, still watching Bat. The cat dashed madly around the cabin twice, running crazily with white ringed eyes and flecks of foam on his muzzle. Then he stopped abruptly in the doorway, stopped and looked back over his shoulder for a long, silent moment. He sniffed delicately. Stina and Cliff could smell it now, too. A thick, oily stench which was not the usual odor left by an exploding blaster shell. Bat came back, treading daintily across the carpet, almost on the tips of his paws. He raised his head as he passed Stina, and then he went confidently beyond to sniff. To sniff and spit twice at the unburned strips of the spaceall. Having thus paid his respects to the late enemy, he sat down calmly and set to washing his fur with deliberation. Stina sighed once and dropped into the navigator's seat. "Maybe now you'll tell me what in the hell's happened," Cliff exploded as he took the blaster out of her hand. "Gray," she said dazedly. "It must have been gray, or I couldn't have seen it like that. I'm colorblind, you see. I can see only shades of gray. My whole world is gray. Like Bat's. His world is gray, too. All gray. But he's been compensated, for he can see above and below our range of color vibrations, and apparently, so can I." Her voice quavered, and she raised her chin with a new air Cliff had never seen before, a sort of proud acceptance. She pushed back her wandering hair, but she made no move to imprison it under the heavy net again. "That is why I saw the thing when it crossed between us against your spaceall. It was another shade of gray, an outline. So I put out mine and waited for it to show against that. It was our only chance, Cliff. It was curious at first, I think, and it knew we couldn't see it, which is why it waited to attack. But when Bat's actions gave it away, it moved. So I waited to see that flicker against the spaceall, and then I let him have it. It's really very simple." Cliff laughed a bit shakily. "But what was this gray thing? I don't get it." "I think it was what made the Empress a derelict. Something out of space, maybe, or from another world somewhere." She waved her hands. "It's invisible because it's a color beyond our range of sight. It must have stayed in here all these years. And it kills, it must, when its curiosity is satisfied." Swiftly she described the scene in the cabin and the strange behavior of the gem pile which had betrayed the creature to her. Cliff did not return his blaster to its holster. "Any more of them on board, do you think?" He didn't look pleased at the prospect. Stina turned to Bat. He was paying particular attention to the space between two front toes in the process of a complete bath. "I don't think so, but Bat will tell us if there are. He can see them clearly, I believe." But there weren't any more, and 2 weeks later Cliff, Stina, and Bat brought the Empress into the lunar quarantine station. And that is the end of Stina's story, because, as we have been told, happy marriages need no chronicles. And Stina had found someone who knew of her gray world and did not find it too hard to share with her. Someone besides Bat. It turned out to be a real love match. The last time I saw her, she was wrapped in a flame-red cloak from the looms of Rigel and wore a fortune in Jovan rubies blazing on her wrists. Cliff was flipping a three-figure credit bill to a waiter, and Bat had a row of vernal juice glasses set up before him. Just a little family party, out on the town.
Well, okay, that's the end of the dramatic presentation portion of Night Transmissions for tonight. And you may wonder why you keep hearing me pleading over and over again for somebody, anybody, to drop me an email at nighttransmissions@gmail.com or drop by the website, nighttransmissions.com, and use the contact button there to contact me. Well, it's because I get lonely. And I do wonder sometimes how many people are listening. People do occasionally drop me an email, and you wouldn't believe how much I appreciate it.
You gotta walk that lonesome valley. You gotta go there by yourself. Nobody here can go there for you. You gotta go there by yourself. Papa gotta walk, walk, walk the lonesome valley. He's gotta go there by himself. Ain't nobody here can go there for him. He's gotta go there by himself. Your mother gotta walk, walk, walk the lonesome valley. She's gotta go there by herself. Now ain't nobody here can go there for her. She's gotta go there by herself. You gotta walk, walk, walk the lonesome valley. You gotta go, go, go there by yourself. Ain't nobody here can go there for you. You've got to go there by yourself.
And it goes round, round, round as it skims along with the happy sound as it goes along the ground, ground, ground till it leads you to the one you love. Then your love will hold you round, round, round in your heart's a song with a brand new sound and your head go spinning round, 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 'cause you found what you've been dreaming of. In the night you see the oval moon going round and round in tune, and the ball of sun in the day makes a girl and boy wanna say, find the ring,
find the ring,
and put it round, 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 and with ties so strong, the two hearts are bound, put it on, the one you found, 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 for you know that this is really love. Find a wee, and it goes round, round, round as it skims along with a happy sound as it goes along the ground, ground, ground till it leads you to the one you love. Then your love, you'll hold a round, round, round in your heart's a song with a brand new sound and your head. You're spinning round, 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 'cause you found what you've been dreaming of. In the night you see the over moon going round and round in two, and the ball of sun in the day makes a girl and boy wanna say, find the ring and put it round, 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 and with ties so strong your two hearts are bound, put it on, the one you found, 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 for you know that this is really love. Find the ring, put it on, for you know that this is really love, really love, really love.
street all through the evening. I hear that you're building your little house deep in the desert. You're living for nothing now. Hope you're keeping some kind of record. Yes, and Jane came by with a lock of your hair. She said that you gave it to her on the night that you planned to go. Famous blue raincoat torn at the shoulder. Been to the station to meet every train. You came home alone with a Lily Morlane. You treated my woman to a flake of your life. She came back. She was nobody's wife. Well, I see you there with a rose in your teeth. One more thin gypsy thief. I see James away. On the night that you planned to go.